You're listening to the Meet the Farmers podcast with me, your host, Ben Eagle. For previous episodes, visit thinkingcountry.com or find the podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud by searching for Meet the Farmers. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is episode 42 of Meet the Farmers, and we're focusing on poultry today. For this episode, I'm heading to Suffolk, and my guest is Alistair Bryce, who runs Havensfield Happy Hens with his wife Fiona. Starting in 2003 with just 300 hens, Alistair and Fiona now work with 16 other farmers across Suffolk and Norfolk, as well as having expanded their own flock. In total, they have about 16,000 free-range birds of their own, and a further 160,000 birds on contract to them, selling around 1 million eggs per week under the Havensfield Happy Hens brand. So let's head over to Alistair in Suffolk. I hope you enjoy the show, and special thanks to the Chadacre Agricultural Trust who are supporting this episode. Alistair, thank you for having me today. Tell me about this part of Suffolk, first of all. Have you always been a Suffolk man?
Well, always within sort of 5 or 6 miles of here. We're right on the Norfolk-Suffolk border with the Waveney Valley running right through. It's quite a picturesque. It's not the typical East Anglia flat, barren, arable landscape that people think of. It is quite undulating through here, and it's a nice valley and a nice place to live.
Why did you get into farming in the first place?
Well, my dad was a pig farmer in the late 80s, but unfortunately went through a lot of problems with the changes in the sow stall that was implemented with joining of the European Union at the time, and just the general turbulence of pig farming in general, the ups and downs. So he came out of pigs, and we ended up living in a small house on the outskirts of a town. And I was always thought I was going to be farming, and that changed at the age of 9 when we sold the farm. So my heart was ripped out. I always wanted to farm, but I never thought I would be able to. You know, it's one of those things where you have a dream, but it's very difficult to be a first-generation farmer. 30, 40 years ago, it's even harder now today.
What changed then?
Well, first I got an education, went and got a degree in agriculture at Seal Lane Agriculture College. One of the things I always thought in terms of degrees, they're a way of buying time to find out what you really want to do. And I know that probably is the case for some degrees today. But with agriculture, it's very specific, and it's within the degree I did, I chose a route where I tried to match what my ambitions were. And realistically, there was no point doing an arable led degree because I was never going to be able to buy 800 acres of prime arable land in East Anglia. It was always going to be out of my reach.
And you didn't have any interest in becoming an arable manager?
No, because I always wanted to be my own man and my own boss. So the route was looking at intensive livestock, and with that was pig and poultry. And, you know, there was opportunities. You had to take big risks and you had to work hard. But I've seen various other people do it over the last 20 or 30 years and been quite successful out of it. So I looked at pigs and poultry, and it was a natural route. And then I wanted to look and see how to value add to it and try to get to the end consumer. Pigs is very difficult unless you're doing small scale hog roasts or farmers markets. But with the eggs, it was actually quite simple. It's a very simple process, which is what drew me to marketing of free range eggs.
When did you meet Fiona? Was this before you got your hens or after you got your hens?
No, it was we were together from young farmers from an age of 20, and she was 17. And the driving force behind the actual going into the egg side was really a hobby to start with. Yeah. I was fully employed by a large pig company as a fields person, and we were selling free-range eggs at the front gate and building a brand and awareness and trying to get an understanding of the market, because it was a growing market at the time.
And how does it work between the two of you and who else is working on the farm at the moment?
Okay, so I'm optimistic and Fiona's very pessimistic. So from the point of view of making business decisions, it's quite a heated debate at times because our two opinions clash quite a bit. And I think as you get older, you get more pessimistic as well. You know, I think you have, when you're young, you have a fire in your belly and you can conquer the world and you can do everything. And as you get older, you realize that, you know, there's no need to, or there's, you know, there's more to life than being the richest man in the graveyard. So she's very good because she does pull me back and she does make me actually look at everything in much finer detail. So we complement one another and each other in that respect. Fiona manages the egg shed in terms of the grading and sorting out the orders. I look after all the producers in terms of the farmers, sorting out the pullets, sorting out the feed, looking at pricing. Then obviously we've got pigs, cattle and sheep involved in the farm as well, and I run those. So Fiona very much concentrates on day-to-day management of grading and the orders. And we have two key staff in the office, a general manager, which takes on the responsibility of our liquid egg, which is a new project which has been running now for a year. And then we've got my mother-in-law who runs all the accounts side and does all the administration. So it's very much a small team. We don't have middle managers anywhere else in the business. The decision's made normally very quickly. It's not a case of going through a chain of command.
So tell me how you went from your 300 hens to where you are today, working across multiple different farms, working with multiple different producers, and selling a million eggs a week.
Yeah, well, it's very difficult because you soon learn that to be able to service any market, whether it's small, medium or large size market in terms of volumes, you need to have a structured laying flock, which is broken down into many, many individual modules. So you've got chickens of different ages spread throughout the whole year. So you have continuity of supply, because when a flock of chickens is depleted, that particular farm quite often isn't coming back into eggs for 8 to 10 weeks. And when they do come in, they come back into a small egg. Well, there's not much demand for small eggs in retail. So you have to almost bear in mind that unit may not be producing eggs that are suitable for the shell market for up to 3 months from when the last chicken leaves. So you have huge holes in productivity when flocks deplete. So you have to cover them with other flocks. Hence, when we had 300 chickens, we had three flocks of 100.
Yep.
Then we went to 900 chickens where we had three flocks of 300. And even then you had shortfalls at certain times of the year. And we soon learned a very valuable lesson in that having all your eggs in one basket on one farm as well is not always the right thing to do, because you can have disease, you can have other issues with, you know, pests and such like. And so having your flock spread throughout a larger geographic area helps minimise that risk. So when bird flu came along, we suddenly realised that, yeah, great, we've got flocks in Norfolk and Suffolk, but actually we've got clusters of farms,
yep,
in very small hotspots.
Yep.
And when DEFRA released the AI plans where they had high risk and low risk, which had no science attached to it at all, apart from water masses, we suddenly realised, well, we're on the Waveney Valley. We have water mass right the way through the biggest part of our production. So that didn't bode very well if there was an outbreak, and they did put zones up. So we tended to then look for new producers that were a little bit further flung, North Norfolk, East Norfolk and sort of South Suffolk, and that enabled us to just spread that base to make sure we were safeguarding a supply of eggs.
How did bird flu impact on you directly?
Oh, massively, because we had an outbreak just 6 miles from the packing station in a small hobby flock.
Wow.
And that put us in the zone. That was extremely, a lot of pressure, a lot of stress, a lot of paperwork, a lot of rigmarole, which we as a business had to go through. And if we breached any of it, we'd have been hung, drawn and quartered, where the next minute you were driving down the road and you'd see a hobby flock of chickens scratching out in the garden. I'm thinking, well, yeah, hang on. If we had one chicken out on the range, we'd be prosecuted. How can this be right? And, you know, I fought long and hard with DEFRA and, you know, to try and get their ear to make it more sensible, because it's not a case of commercial flocks were no more at risk of bird flu than the hobby flocks. In fact, the hobby flocks proved to be the biggest risk to bird flu, because they weren't feeding in a safeguarded area. They were feeding outside, which has attracted the wild birds. No vermin control. Birds were roaming willy-nilly anywhere.
How well prepared do you think you are as a sector, and the poultry sector is today, and prepared DEFRA is if another outbreak were to occur?
Yeah, I think with DEFRA, there's certainly an element of them being under-resourced, and they need to take more of a proactive approach and listen to people on the ground and use us as advisors as much as anything. Not that we have all the answers, but collectively we can come up with a better solution than they can sitting in an office in London. I think they have learned some lessons, but even still, those AI high-risk areas are still present on no scientific data. You know, you can't put someone's business at jeopardy because someone's blindfolded and chucked a dart at a map. It doesn't make any sense at all. And we proved to them that actually the migratory bird pattern and the area of water has no correlation to where the bird flu actually occurred. Thankfully, the last year, two years, bird flu has been non-existent. But that's not to say it's not out there.
Who are your customers and what are they expecting?
Right, well, our customers are 750 independent customers. We have a small regional multiple retailer, which is basically the East of England Co-op, who have promoted and supported us for the last 9 years. And we've grown and developed a range of eggs with them, and it's been a real success story. On the back of that, we've got 749 other customers, which can range from a small village shop to a pub. So we're looking at catering, we're looking at hospitality, universities, schools, and we've got a very broad client base, wholesalers. We run three lorries on the road, so and four vans delivering direct, and they're out 5 days a week. The nice thing about it is as a business, I always thought I don't want anyone having more than 15% of my business.
Okay,
so no single customer has more than 15% of our overall output, and that means I can sleep at night.
Yeah.
And if you look at lots of the other larger packers, they do millions in a day. We do millions in a week. Yeah. So if you look at it, they'll only have maybe two key accounts. It could be Morrisons or Sainsbury's or Tesco's and Asda. And so when it comes up for tendering for a new supply, they're so heavily committed, because if they lose it, what do they do?
At what point do you stop taking on new customers?
Well, as I was talking about, the free-range market at the moment is in oversupply. There's been so much expansion, mainly in Northern Ireland and Wales, because of huge capital grants that were given from the EU for less privileged areas. And there's actually more chickens in Wales now than there are sheep. And that brings about its own problems with emissions over in Wales. So suddenly they're realising all the ammonia. A sheep doesn't give off much ammonia, whereas a lot of the intensive free-range chicken units do when they're turned round. There's lots of challenges, but at the moment, you know, in terms of where we go, the customer is looking for consistency, good quality. And what we do is we try and make sure that the shell egg market is very particular in the fact they don't like white eggs, and they like a nice, glossy, brown shelled egg, okay? Anything other than that, they don't like. So what we try and do is make sure that we pick hard on the grader. Anything that isn't quite right gets put into liquid egg. So it gives us an opportunity to keep our standards high at the shell egg, because when a flock gets older, the quality decreases. The egg is still the same inside, but the shell doesn't look quite so appealing. So it's about making sure you market to the right brand. As a company, we've got four brands that we operate, and you know, they're of different categories in terms of different qualities. So it's making sure that the egg yolk is consistent in colour as well. So we have our own feed ration, which is formulated to give us a more richer, darker yolk, which is a natural additive which is put in there in terms of paprika, which will make the yolk more orangey red. And you know, people, whether it be chefs, they see that as a sign of quality.
Yep.
If you buy a supermarket egg, quite often it's quite yellow and insipid, and that doesn't give that instant wow factor. So it's just little things. And obviously our name is a great brand. It tells the story without even knowing what we do.
I know the answer to this, but where did the name come from?
Yeah, we had a little field called Havensfield, yeah. And I sort of tongue-in-cheek said, well, what about Havensfield Happy Hens? And when you're starting off having little printed labels sticking on egg boxes, it's very romantic.
Yeah.
And now we have lorry loads of cartons come in from Scandinavia every 3 or 4 weeks of our printed label boxes. And it makes you feel quite proud.
Yeah.
Because at the time, I didn't think it, you know, marketing wasn't my thing. I was a farmer.
Yeah.
Yeah. But now you look back and we probably wouldn't be the business we are today without that brand.
Yeah.
Because any, you know, if you look at the egg market going back 30 years ago, there wasn't a brand. It was just free range, caged and barn. And they weren't made sexy on the shelf. Now, if you look at an egg display in a supermarket, they're wow. You know, a range of colours. It's almost too confusing.
Mm.
So it's about giving really good service and making sure you go the extra mile for every customer. Because at the end of the day, you know, customers are king. And they're always right. And, you know, we do have complaints on eggs sometimes, but quite often, if you talk to the customer and you get an understanding of where the eggs are being stored or what they're being used for, there's an explanation. Things always happen for a reason. That is my saying, and my wife hates it. Because when the grader breaks down, it's like, oh, bloomin' grader, we need a new one. And then you look at the bearing and it hasn't been greased for 2 weeks or something like that. And my saying is, things always happen for a reason, dear.
It's easier way, going through life.
Yeah.
The dreaded B word. How Brexit-proof are you at the moment? And how might changing agricultural and food policy impact on you here?
Well, that's a huge question because nobody really knows the answer yet. We've been preparing for Brexit. We prepared for the last Brexit that never happened.
You might be preparing the October Brexit, which may or may not happen.
Well, I think because the last one didn't happen, I'm taking a slightly lighter-hearted approach that the next one isn't going to happen, which is probably wrong. Because knowing what's going on in the Conservative leadership at the moment, if one particular person gets it, it will happen come what may. And I don't think whatever you plan for, it will be right. Because to drop out of the EU without any form of deal will be a disaster for every single agricultural sector. There may be some gains in the short term, but long term, it will be painful. Mm-hmm. I think where we are most vulnerable is packaging. All of our pulp packaging comes from Scandinavia and now Poland and Romania and those sorts of countries. The actual problem we've got, there's no UK manufacturer of that. There's no other option. If there is disruption, it's how do we get eggs to our customers? Because last time we stockpiled probably twice as much packaging in the hope that that would get us 8 weeks further on. But in terms of capital, that's £150,000 of cardboard in effect. Everyone else does the same. So then the manufacturers say, we can't commit that order because we're overproducing. We won't be able to get it to you. So the scare factor is what then pushes the price up. So all that happens is your costs go up. Your capital in the business is drained by having so much stock. And then on the back of that, we haven't got any answers in terms of finding a long-term solution of a UK manufacturer. So yeah,
a nice optimistic story.
Yeah, because it's quite difficult to transport eggs without the cartons.
Yeah.
And and we've had this argument when business rates, the council wants to come and charge us business rates for the packing house. And it was like, okay, well, if you can show me how we can transport the egg without the use of packaging, I'm happy if you can come up with a solution not to to pay business rates on the area where we keep the packaging. And in the end, funnily agree enough. Funnily enough, you can't send eggs in bulkers.
So you're clearly always looking to innovate, and you've recently brought out your liquid egg product.
Yeah.
Tell me about that and the reason behind that.
So again, that came about for two reasons, really. One was bird flu. If you were in a high-risk zone, you could have your farm closed down for quite a lengthy time until you can get eggs moved off. Well, in the shell egg market, which is what we're predominantly in, you've got to be able to service your customer with a shelf life of 24 days. The most you can give them is 28 days from the date of lay. But 4 days turnaround time is really what you're looking at. So if a farm gets tied up with bird flu, they could be on the farm for a week. So you've lost that window of opportunity. And by that week has gone, your opportunity to sell those eggs into a shell market, into retail, has gone. So then you're looking at selling them to processing. And obviously at that time, there'd be a swell of eggs coming into processing and the price would plummet. So we looked at liquid egg. We went to France a couple of times and looked at a couple of little setups. Not something that we do a great deal of in the UK. We rely on a lot of imported egg, liquid egg, from Belgium, France, Germany, and Holland to go into large food manufacturing. And we came back and we thought about it for a good couple of years, and then new salmonella regulations came in, and we have the cleanest, safest eggs in the world. We've got a great vaccination program, a great screening program. There's hardly any incidence of salmonella. So what do the health standards agency think of doing? They bring in more types of salmonella to screen for. We are actually farming free-range chickens. So we do actually have other birds that could be carrying salmonella. Seagulls, crows, rooks, magpies.
Yeah, that's very topical at the
moment. Starlings, yep. So the risk is higher. And the more they screen, the more likely they're going to find it eventually. So we thought, right, with salmonella positive eggs, you can still process them because the whole process of pasteurization is total kill, sterilization. So we thought, well, as a safeguard for all our producers, should they get a flock go down with salmonella, there's a route out of the problem. Yep. It's not ideal.
Yeah.
It's not going to be financially great, but it's going to minimize the loss. So that makes it, those two reasons made it viable then for us to look into a European grant to help us facilitate the purchasing of the production unit.
I've got a few general accepted questions. You mentioned salmonella earlier on. For the benefit of younger listeners, can you talk about the impact that Edwina Curry's comments had back in the 1980s, where she implied that all British eggs, or the majority of British eggs, were infected by salmonella?
Yeah, that was a major catastrophe for the whole egg industry at the time. It didn't matter whether you were caged, free range, whatever. The whole sector crumpled because egg consumption just fell overnight. And it put much of the market under pressure, and to the point where people were depleting their flocks because there was just no market for the egg. And that's left a lasting legacy, really, because there's a whole generation of people that were quite influenced at that point in time of their life, being, you know, around about 16 to 30 years of age, that remember that. And that is my age as well. So, you know, you remember that period of time that actually eggs are not good for you, you know. And at the same point, there was things being cast around where they're high in cholesterol and they'll give you heart attacks. So it wasn't just salmonella. There are other health issues that were bounded around about eggs, which have proved to be non-factual. Mm. And in fact, Edwina Curry, what she meant to say was, and she's admitted to this now, that imported eggs have a higher incidence of salmonella, but obviously it got lost in translation. So, you know,
that's good to clarify.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the UK egg market and the eggs that on average we eat per person per year, we lag way, way behind the rest of the European countries. On average, we eat now about 190 eggs per person per year. Back then, it was probably about 160. Okay, and what's happened now is because of the omega-3, in terms of certain amino acids within eggs, which you can't get from other foods, and that's now being promoted more. The fact that there isn't any salmonella in the UK flocks is great news for what we've been doing with the screening, which means that runny eggs are safe now for vulnerable groups. And the Food Standards Agency said that only 18 months ago. And on the back of that, we've obviously now got consumption now rising because they're now seen as a superfood. And you've got the older generation are eating more. And more importantly, we've got the younger generation eating them. But there is still that 40...
In the middle.
Yeah, you know, this 40-year-old age group at the moment that have an issue.
It's almost like being trained into their brains
for
that time.
Yeah, but, you know, if you look at egg consumption, it's increasing year on year. We're going in the right direction. But we are still about 20 to 30 eggs per person per year below what the European average is.
Hmm. Tell me about the British Free Range Egg Producers Association and their role.
So BREFREPRA are an organisation which is basically run by members. We're obviously a member of it. We have a council and we try and put ideas forward. We have a strong producer base which enables a great deal of expertise to be put in. And within that, we're looking at doing various studies and trials to see how we can improve welfare going forward. Obviously, we've got the beak trimming ban that's going to come in, which means that the tiny tip of the beak on the upper beak can't be trimmed, which historically was used for stopping feather pecking and aggressive behaviour. Well, they want to rule that out. So we've got to be faced with chickens that have full beaks, intact beaks, which if they do form aggression, it can be very, very severe and very, very difficult to eradicate. But what's happening now with genetics companies along with the vets and everything and the nutritionists, it's making the birds more placid. We've got new generations out in terms of making them less likely to be aggressive. But there are always downsides. Mother Nature's always wins because if they're less aggressive, they tend to be slightly dopier And they don't move around so much, so they don't range as much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the whole point of free range is get them out.
Yeah.
And on the other side of it is we've now got new systems coming in with multi-tiers whereby they have to work a lot harder, which is more natural of a sort of a jungle situation where they have multi-tiers and aerial perching. And you have to have birds that will explore. So you want birds. It's very difficult because there's so much changed in the industry in such a short space of time, and genetics takes many, many generations. So we've got lots of things going on, but Bafrepra is really there to help us as a producer base to promote the industry and to look and trial different things and to question what we're doing. As farmers, you have to always think, why do I do that? It's no point I do that because Dad used to do it. We have to challenge what we do every day and make sure we look at it in a different light to make sure that we look at it sometime as a consumer, not just as a farmer. What do they expect from us? How do they perceive the industry to be? The problem we've got now is because of the economics involved is free range, the average size of free range units is growing rapidly because if you're earning less per bird, people feel like they've got to have more birds. And so we've got this increase in average size, which is making it from a traditional free-range farm to what could be perceived as an industrial free-range farm. And that is my biggest concern mm-hmm. going forward. And the Bafrepra share those views because we don't want to lose public support.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the average size flock for my business is about 8,000 birds. Okay. We have got 16,000 birds on some in some sheds. But then we've got lots of sheds that have 2,000 birds. If you look at the national average now, it's 24,000 birds, 22 to 24,000 birds. So you can see my 8,000 is very small. So the scales, the economies of scales are working against what is perceived by the public. And my concern is how far that gets taken. Because if the margins get slashed to a very small margin, then the units will have to get bigger or they'll be not viable. And you know, I've got a producer who's packed up in the last 8 months just because he's got 6,000 birds and it was not viable. He's had to go out and get a job because the margins have come down so much. And if you look at eggs on the supermarket shelf now, free range eggs, they're actually cheaper than they were 25 years ago. Well, I can't think of one input that we put into producing a free range egg that is cheaper. Everything has gone up in price considerably. So it's really difficult to make the two ends meet.
We've got a really specific question in from Twitter, from Daniel Brown. What are your thoughts on feed tracker contracts?
I'm totally against free feed trackers. They distort the market. They've also led to a huge expansion because basically a feed tracker is a mechanism whereby egg price will track your feed price. So if feed price goes up...
Okay.
Your egg price will go up. If feed price goes down, your egg price will go down. You work to a margin, and the margin's quite small. But what that's enabled to do is it's taken out the free market of the whole of the sector. And a lot of supermarkets like it because they tie their production base in with their packer, and they think they safeguard their supply. And that was fine when there's a shortage of eggs, because that's why the supermarket wanted it done. It was to preserve their supply and make sure their shelves weren't empty. What that's done over the last 6 or 7 years is it's created now an oversupply because you as a farmer, if you're a sheep farmer in North Wales with 1,000 upland ewes earning £12,000 a year, and you come and you look at the free range egg opportunity and you might have to spend £500,000, but what you're told is you've got 16,000 birds in that shed and you can earn £5 a bird, okay? So you're looking at £80,000 profit or 1,000 upland sheep earning 12 grand. So they go to the bank. The bank goes, well, we need to see a contract. The contract comes out from a packer, feed contract linked to feed, ticks the box for the bank. Bank lends the money, shed goes up. And that's what's happened.
Okay.
And that is why we're in this situation now.
That's why there's been so much growth in such a short amount of time.
Absolutely. And you know, the egg industry, we're in a very strange position at the moment because the supermarkets are committed to 2025 to not sell caged colony-enriched eggs. Okay. So they're saying they're going to find an alternative for that egg, but they won't commit to barn, and they're saying they've got to have an economy egg. So what they've done, they've almost fueled the expansion of free range to basically undermine the market, to reduce the price to a point where free range is now the normal. So free range makes up over half the market now, and whereas it used to be a very niche market, it's become the majority. So suddenly that's where the premium disappears. So feed trackers distort the market, they don't help the market, and they don't help the producer in the long term. And there's a real disparity because if you look at those on feed trackers and those that are off feed trackers, quite often there's lots of caveats. If they go on a feed tracker, they have to buy the feed from a nominated source, their pullets from a nominated source. And if you look at their costings, the feed and the pullets are quite often more expensive. So it's not as black and white as it first seems. And in any market, supply and demand needs to be the overriding factor that keeps balance, okay? Feed trackers have created a massive oversupply of eggs. Now, that oversupply now means that feed trackers aren't being offered in the marketplace. They're being withdrawn because certain supermarkets can now see that they can pick up free-range eggs cheaper on the spot market than they can from their feed trackers. So they're not going to be caught at a disadvantage with an expensive egg on the shelf. They're going to start saying, right, cut out those feed tracker deals. They expire in 2 years. We're not going to renew them. And the problem is a feed tracker quite often work for four to five flocks. These farms have taken out mortgages for 15 or 25 years. So what is going to happen after their first commitment, their first 4 year, 5 year flock contract, when it gets renewed? They're going to find that their projected income is going to be drastically slashed. And that's what's happening up and down the country right now, because the market can't sustain it. You can't sustain subsidising a product because of high feed. And if you look at now, feed prices are starting to fall back. Well, egg prices are going to fall back, but they're going to fall back a lot quicker than they would have done had you not have been on a feed contract.
And my next question was, but I probably already know the answer to this. It's in the east of England specifically, is there room for any more poultry growth?
Well, we've turned people away over the last 3 or 4 months because I'm a very much, if I haven't got the market and I see a market that's in free fall, then why make it worse? You know, we've got planning for a unit of our own expansion. We've just got it on hold because it's no point adding to the woes of the industry. There's an awful lot of young people that have come into this industry with no previous knowledge or experience of it. Diversification has been a great word that's been bandied around for 20 years. And because the free-range egg market was one of the, you know, success stories,
yeah,
an awful lot of people have diversified and put a free-range chicken shed up. And you look at it now, and it's probably to the point where it's barely viable at the current situation. So we're going to have to lose 3 million birds out of the UK flock to make it viable again. Because at the moment, we've got a record number. We've got over 40 million laying birds in the UK, which is an awful lot of birds. We're normally around 37 million, and we can keep supply and demand in balance. There's just too many birds at the moment. And when we get to 2025, that might be balanced better with some of the colony cage units being taken out of production. But the problem with that is if you've got a colony caged egg, which is your basic bog standard egg, which puts a bottom in the market, they're your bargain egg. If they disappear, free range becomes the normal. Well, how do you maintain a premium? You can't. So if that's why the supermarket shelves have become so busy with brands trying to offer you different things and catch your eye, because it's a really aggressive market to try and keep a brand and try and maintain a premium. So one of our things is small flocks. So people can honestly then say that actually, yeah, they aren't going to be coming from a farm that has 84,000 free-range chickens on, half the size of our whole business,
yeah,
which is what you've got going on. So, you know, the smaller the size flock, the more they range, the more you know, the more close you are to the perception of what free range is. I mean, there's certain companies that advertise on the telly and they show a quad bike going through an orchard with little tiny wooden huts. That's an idyllic scene, but it's not the reality.
Yeah, I mean, but based on that, so we first met at the Suffolk Show, which is all about bridging the public and farming and food production in the East. And I think there's generally more awareness amongst the farming community that we need to do more and more interesting projects to do with public engagement in farming. Do you think that the egg sector is doing enough?
Certainly when there's issues with bird flu, it's difficult to engage because getting people onto the farms is not always that easy.
Mm.
I think where we can engage is doing things like this. We do lots of food fairs and events. The problem is we've probably got 10% of the public care where their food's from. 90% just want price.
Yeah.
Availability and price. And that's, you know, maybe 10% is overestimated. Well, it's not until they haven't got it on the shelf that they care. And at the moment, we've got loads of free-range eggs on the shelf. So they're not questioning it. Going back 10, 15 years ago, there wasn't always free-range eggs on the shelf. So we've almost made it harder to engage because how successful the industry's been. But that doesn't mean we can be complacent. We've still got to try and do more. And the good thing about free-range eggs, and the reason why it's been so successful is you know, okay, you can buy free-range pork, but you've got to kill a pig, right? With a free-range chicken, you're giving it a way of life which is different from the alternative.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best possible life for that chicken while it's on the ground. I accept at the end of the flock, it does get processed and it goes for things like soup, but it's still utilised. You know, so people buy into it that while I'm buying a free-range egg, I'm supporting that chicken. So to do that, people have got to see that the units don't grow too big, too industrial. Otherwise, it's actually, it's not money well spent. So we've got to keep engaging with them. And that's why, you know, looking at the larger size sheds, we've got to make sure that they are in the realms of what free range is perceived as. Because I think long term, those big sheds will become the value bog standard egg.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they will become. And that's why, you know, we look at the small flock scenario, what we brand ourselves on. It's important to put us on one side to make sure we stand away from mainline, the mainstream. Because otherwise, we can't swim with those. We'll never compete. You know, on the efficiencies that they have, we can't.
Mm.
You know, our overall size, 160,000 birds, employ 26 people. You know, in terms of the local economy, that's 26 direct, and then there's all the people on the farms. So in terms of infrastructure, it's probably hundreds,
mm.
you know, and wholesalers that are then selling our eggs on. The whole thing about this was I didn't intend to set this business up. This has grown organically.
Yeah.
It's almost like started off as a small business and a very, very simple concept, and it's just taken on more and more. But that's been built around the brand, and that's the success of the brand is the way we package and how we do the egg in the first place. And we have people email us all the time saying, where can we get your eggs? They're lovely. I've been on holiday. I come from Wiltshire. Do you sell them anywhere in Wiltshire? It's like, no, we're just East Anglian based. And, you know, that's great. We love that sort of feedback. And we, you know, we do get a lot of that. So that's what you get out of bed for sometimes, that little bit of well done.
I do have a few more good if you go outside, mainly because I'm so hot in
yeah,
here.
Yeah.
I need to actually get up and have a wander about.
Have a look.
They have duck eggs, look?
Yeah, of course, yeah, because you are producing duck, quail and goose eggs.
That's
as well.
Right, yeah. So the duck eggs, we used to be free range, but they're in North Norfolk, the ducks. And obviously North Norfolk is quite a high-risk area for avian flu.
Yeah.
And ducks are also very prone to avian flu. So we had to bring them in. They're now housed in large cattle area sheds on deep straw for their own safety, really, and also for the safety of farmers in and around Norfolk because, yeah. You know, avian flu is still around. And the quail, they're all produced on the same farm as the duck eggs. And again, we probably sell 5,000 dozen quail eggs a week and probably about 3,500 duck eggs. So it's a lot of speciality eggs, we call them, Goose eggs are seasonal. We produce them here on the farm. They're all housed inside as well in a large polytunnel type arrangement on straw. And they start laying Christmas Day, and they stop generally around about the middle of May. But this year they stopped a lot earlier because it got so hot. Mm-hmm. And that caused us problems because, you know, you only have a limited laying period with geese. So when it gets hot, they just stop laying. So we, instead of getting 40 to 50 eggs per goose, I reckon we're probably down to high 20s, which isn't great because we have a really good market for goose eggs, and it's something we're trying to build on. And this year we had to retract because we just couldn't supply. So very difficult because geese are a long-term investment. They don't lay very many in their first year, and what eggs they do lay are very small, so they're not that marketable. It's really the second year that you get, second and third year, you get the full benefit of them. Okay. And then fourth and fifth year, they start to decrease in production. So to lose a year like we have this year, we've probably lost the equivalent of 2 years because the way it works, a very short window. But there we go, that's farming. We
expect to say, you're going to be up and down, and that's why you have...
A diverse business, yeah. And I think I learned that from my dad, seeing, as a small kid, seeing my dad's whole income reliant on pigs.
So clearly you are incredibly busy with the business, but are you able to shut off? Do you have other things, sort of things outside of the farm that you enjoy doing that mean you can close the door and... just for 5 minutes, stop.
I do. My passion is breeding exotic birds.
Oh, cool.
Which is great, but they still need feeding and looking after 7 days a week. So it's like a busman's holiday, really. And it's got to the point where it was a hobby, and now it's got quite big, and it takes up an awful lot of time. And obviously you get this time of year in the breeding season, it takes up even more time. But it does allow me to just escape, and it's a challenge to breed some of these exotic birds. And my oldest son is really keen in them as well. But yeah, I wish I could just go and play snooker or go to the pub, but I couldn't pay £4 for a pint and feel I'm relaxing. Do you know what I mean? It's quite difficult. I think as a farmer, I'm not tight, but I just like, I have what I want if I can afford it. But it has to be, I have to feel that, you know, it's worth it.
Right, before we close, we're going to try the 1 minute soapbox. So listeners, this gives guests an opportunity to speak for 1 minute on a subject of their choice. Just realised I don't have my smartphone on me, so I can't actually time this, but I'll have to look on the thing to... and I'll just give you a 10-second warning. So this is talking for any subject at all, farming or non-farming. And Alistair, you have a subject.
Yes, and it's the agricultural labour issue.
Brilliant. So 1 minute, starting now.
Okay, so when I was younger, I would work on many farms. There wasn't health and safety as it is today. Farms were smaller and machinery was far easier to operate, which enabled young people to get out on farms and learn the basics very quickly and engage and see if they liked agriculture. And there was a whole number of me and friends, we'd all do it, go and help corn cart or hay cart. It's great fun. Today, if you look at agriculture, those opportunities have gone. And I just wonder for the future how we get these young people on farms, because even I get offered apprenticeships to come and work for me, but actually the health and safety is too onerous. And it doesn't make you want to engage and bring young people on the farm. So we have to do something to simplify it and make it more easier for young people to get on farms to see if they like agriculture, and also make it sexy.
Brilliant. That was pretty much bang on. Great.
Yeah, it's very difficult, isn't it?
It is really difficult, really difficult.
I think because I've been up since 3 o'clock and I reckon I've drunk so many litres of water. I'm busting. I'm only normally 9 stone, but today I must be 14.
Well, thank you so much for letting me come and
That's fine.
Learn more about the egg sector, and yeah, good luck for everything you're doing here.
That's it for today. That was Alistair Bryce talking to me on his farm in Suffolk. Next time, we're talking all things conservation, food and farming. I'll be at the Tendering 100 show, which is my local agricultural show, where I'm speaking to a range of different people about conservation and farming, food and the wider countryside. So I hope you can join me for that. In the meantime, you can catch all previous episodes on thinkingcountry.com, on SoundCloud, on iTunes or on eatfarmnow.com. I want to thank the Chadacre Agricultural Trust for supporting this episode. I also want to thank Tom Bland for his help with production. And to you for listening. Please do tell your friends and family about the podcast. It's always good to have new listeners. So I'll look forward to you joining me next time on Meet the Farmers.